Okay, I want to do this last case in chapter 3. And some of you have, I think there are different versions as I look out here, different versions of the text. And some of you have material after the end of the chapter. But after Jewett versus Deutsch. How many people have material in the California statute after that? Okay, most of you do. Some of you got an older version. They're virtually identical except for this one thing. I think I mentioned it at the time when we were doing wrongful death statutes. So just, and I, the one I was looking at when we were doing that, I thought you didn't have it. It turns out you do. So, but let's do Jewett versus Deutsch, and then I'll make some comments about that California statute. Okay. What's going on in Jewett versus Deutsch? Question about the use of a different argument. So this section of chapter 3, as we're coming to the end here, has to do with the kinds of arguments plaintiffs' lawyers get to make in order to enhance the award. And as Melvin Belli brags in his presentation, if you do it right, you can get a much better award than if you don't do it right and you just sort of leave the facts to speak for themselves. The argument we talked about earlier was at the end of the first hour was the argument of this per diem breakdown and whether that should or shouldn't be permissible as a form of argument. The second form of argument we're going to talk about, the so-called send a message argument, is one that is more universally condemned. Now, to be sure, the send a message argument is perfectly appropriate in a punitive damages case. So if we're punishing Ford for making the Pinto with a poorly protected gas tank, or we're punishing Johns Manville because they deliberately hid the evidence about the dangers of asbestos, then the whole purpose of a punitive award is to send a message to people similarly situated to say, don't even think about pulling a stunt like this because we'll whack you later on. But in a compensatory award, where we're, again, trying to sort of refill the plaintiff's tank. It's been emptied out or drawn down by the defendant's negligence, and we're trying to figure out the amount of money to refill the plaintiff's tank. At least in theory, it doesn't matter what the defendant did to cause that, so long as we find the defendant is strictly liable or negligent or otherwise breached some duty that proximately caused the plaintiff's damages. For purposes of coming up with an amount of the award, we're only talking about, well, what damage has the plaintiff suffered, not how much you approve or disapprove of the defendant's conduct. That's in theory. In practice, the plaintiff will be far more successful if the plaintiff's lawyer presents the case as the good guys versus the bad guys. The good guys in the form of the plaintiff trying to remedy this injustice, the defendant as the bad guy who perpetrated this injustice. And that if you buy the defendant's argument, you are accepting a kind of society that none of us would want to live in. Whereas if you find for the plaintiff and give the plaintiff a big sum of money, you will be putting your approval on a way of looking at the world that's far more humane and the kind of world we all want to live in. One of the classic ways this was done was in the case, the largest civil recovery ever made. It was Pennzoil versus Texaco. And it involved the sale or transfer of some oil leases. I think it was actually the Getty Oil Company that was sort of on the auction block. Everybody thought there was a prospect for acquiring the stock of the Getty Oil Company. I forget exactly what the details were, but at one point, I'm forgetting the details actually, but Pennzoil had made an initial bargain with the Getty Oil Company, and they sort of had a handshake deal. And later on, Texaco made a better offer, and so they dumped Pennzoil and made the deal with Texaco. And so Pennzoil sued, claiming that there had been this breach of contract, interference with, you know, tortious interference with contractual relations, all these sort of legal theories, which are fairly complex. But Joe Gemmell, who is the lawyer for Pennzoil, tried his case on the theory that this was a violation of sort of a principle of honor. And on the other hand, Texaco said, but this is business. This is like big business. And in big business, you don't have a deal till everybody signs on the dotted line. And we'd never gotten to that point. Well, there was sort of an understanding. You know, I mean, we made positive noises like we were going to do a deal here, but the deal never was consummated. We never had a contract drawn up and people's names actually signed on the dotted line. And so what Joe Gemmell essentially did was he got a Texas jury, and he basically set it up so that you have the Texas way of life on the one hand and this New York way of life on the other hand. Now, in New York, you don't have a deal. But here in Texas, I think it ought to be that when I say to somebody, we got a deal, don't we? It was a little more complicated than that, but you get the picture here that faced with that, he planned this all out never tires of telling people how smart he was about doing this, but he did get a $9.3 billion judgment. And, you know, which is, they finally settled it, I think, for $7 billion, of which he got a third. So, I guess he is pretty smart. And no one asks him, if you're so smart, why ain't you rich? He did a very good job of essentially making this a modern morality tale. It is not just about the restatement of contracts and what constitutes an offer and an acceptance and so forth. In the end, for the jury, it was a stark choice between, on the one hand, a world in which everything was technical, it's all a bunch of people sitting around in boardrooms playing games, versus a sort of sense of decency in which things matter just because that's the way they are. Now, again, the law in theory says you cannot invite the jury to send a message that invites them to essentially add a sort of punitive component. When you appeal to the jury with respect to the amount of damages, you can only point to the evidence in the record. But that is not to say that you can't do things indirectly that you might not be able to do directly. I'll give you another case as an illustration. This is a Washington case decided about 15 years ago. I think it was called Ayers versus Johnson & Johnson. The case involved a Johnson & Johnson, you know, Band-Aids, baby oil, etc. This was a case of the family. There was a, I forget whether the, I think there was a father in the house, I can't remember, but the principal actors in this play are the mother, the teenage daughter, and a two-year-old. There's a bottle of Johnson & Johnson baby oil in the bathroom. Teenage daughter is getting ready to go to the beach. She wants something to put on her skin so it doesn't dry out. And so she sees this bottle of baby oil, doesn't really want to take the baby oil bottle with her, but there's an empty shampoo bottle. So she squeezes a little bit of the Johnson & Johnson baby oil into this shampoo bottle so that she can then use this and then throw it away when she, you know, doesn't have to worry about bringing it back or getting it covered with sand or whatever. As she's getting ready to go out the door, she realizes she's got to make a phone call or she's got to go do something, puts her stuff, her towel and her, you know, this thing of baby oil on the floor and goes off to make the phone call or whatever. Two-year-old comes up to the pile of stuff, playing around as kids will do, takes, actually, maybe she hadn't even put the top on it yet, I can't remember how it is that it, since kid picks up the bottle, puts the bottle to his mouth. Just that moment, the mom comes around the corner, sees this kid, and yells at the kid. He startles and actually aspirates the baby oil. Nobody knows this exactly. It's just this all happens sort of in real time. She said, "What? Did he have shampoo in his mouth?" Hollers at the "Oh no, mom, that's baby oil." Mom goes, "Gee, is this? Should I be worried?" She goes, looks at this thing. It says, "Caution: Do not, for external use only. Do not take internally. Contains mineral oil." Mineral oil. Isn't that like in laxatives and stuff? If he swallows this stuff, yikes, you know, I'll have to do a bunch of loads of laundry here. But the mom's not worried about anything worse than that. Kids continues to sort of sputter and, you know, for 10 minutes or so. She finally realizes he's not, you know, this isn't, so she calls the hospital or the emergency room, and they say, no, bring him in right away. So she brings him in. By the time they get him in, the mineral oil, when it's aspirated, that is, you breathe it in, goes down, not your swallowing stomach, it goes down your windpipe into your lungs. The mineral oil coats the lungs, and then he can't breathe. So when they get him into the emergency room, by that time, they start to begin the treatment to whatever it is they do. But by that time, he suffers cardiac arrest. They can save him, but he has permanent brain damage. Okay, here's the setup in the trial of the case. Plaintiff's claim is Johnson & Johnson was negligent in failing to put a warning on the bottle. Warning, you know, skull and crossbones. You know, if aspirated, can cause serious injury or even death. If that warning had been on the bottle, says the mother, I would have gotten prompt medical care. He would have avoided this terrible. And here's the plaintiff sitting at counsel table. By this time, by the time the case finally goes to trial, the kid's 8 or 9 years old, and he's got brain damage. What's Johnson & Johnson's argument at trial? A warning on baby oil? Look at the way this thing happened. You know, it's in a little squeeze bottle. You've got to work pretty hard to aspirate this stuff. It took the teenager squeezing it into another bottle, putting it in a place where the kid could get it, putting it up to his mouth, etc. What other warnings should we put on? Warning, do not cook with this. You know, not for use as a motor, you know, automotive lubricant, you know. I mean, I got these little, you know, cherubs around the edge of the label here. It's baby oil, you know. This isn't plutonium or something. Plaintiff's argument is, oh, I get it. He's not worth it. Ladies and gentlemen, if you don't think my client deserved a normal life, you go ahead and, you know, fine for the defendant. But if you think, you know, well, this is send a message. You either want to live in a society in which every human being has value, or you live in a society in which, oh, they just, you know, count depending on, you know, they're all just a statistic. So the plaintiff's lawyer, if they are, and you have to avoid being overly emotional about these things, but you can easily set the case up so that it is a question about what sort of society do you want to live in. Now, the defendant, I suppose, could do a similar kind of thing. Oh, do you want to live in a society in which everything is, you know, idiot-proofed? So, yeah, okay, you put a sunscreen up on your windshield, and on the back of the, you know, sunscreen on your windshield says, warning, do not drive while this is in place. You know, if that's where we're all headed, but I don't want to live in a world like that. You know, the defendant could, but it doesn't have the same ring. You know, I can laugh about that. Whereas the plaintiff, when they said, do you want to live in a world in which, you know, people like my client over here doesn't matter, which apparently they don't matter to Johnson & Johnson, because they still won't put a warning on that. You go to the grocery store, you look at a bottle of Johnson & Johnson baby oil, it does not say, warning, if aspirated can cause serious injury or death with a skull and crossbones on it. They continue to sell this stuff, saying, don't take internally. Now, maybe that's a good thing, maybe it's a bad thing, but again, what I'm pointing out is that the send a message argument can be made, you just can't use those words. But I can design, if I'm the plaintiff's lawyer, I can design this case so that that's exactly the impression you get. You have a stark choice, ladies and gentlemen, the jury. Either you sign up with the good guys and pay a boatload of money to the plaintiff, or you're part of the problem. And what's a defendant going to do with that kind of argument? As I say, play the same game only in reverse. We can turn into a bunch of whiny victims out here, or we can be independent, you know, pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, whatever. Well, that doesn't ring very well when you got, you know, little Junior over there with brain damage who's, gosh, anybody would feel bad about Junior. We're not about to say, hey, Junior, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps if you can find them. I mean, it's just... I didn't mean to say that. This sort of came on me here. So, this is the world we live in which whether you by nature find the plaintiff's position, whether you sort of naturally identify with the Trial Lawyers Association and do think that they're wearing the white hats and that they are helping us have a safer society, and if it weren't for the Trial Lawyers Association, we would be governed by heartless people who would sell us to the highest bidder. Or whether you are inclined to think that this is a gigantic scam and there's something you would like to do about it, what I keep harping at you to try to get you to see is this is the tort system. This is the way it functions. This is sort of the engine that makes it go. And yes, there are lots of other, you know, important technical rules that we deal with, but that's not what makes plaintiff's lawyers successful, and it's not what gives defendants nightmares. If you read a civil action, or if you see the movie, I think I've referenced this before, Jeremy Fosher, this guy who he's kind of this classic defense curmudgeon, he gets this case, he gets assigned, you know, he works for a very, you know, prestigious Boston firm, isn't it? Yeah, I can't remember which one he works for. Or maybe it's a New York firm. I can't remember who it is he works for. Anyway, some just classic, very good firm. He's a very smart guy, very successful. And he gets this case, and he looks at it, and he says, job one is never, never let the victims get on the witness stand. If they got on the witness stand, my client is a dead duck. So he, from day one, figures out a way procedurally, and he, by golly, he's successful. He manages to bifurcate the liability issues from the damages issues so the jury never does hear from the victims. They hear about geology and about, you know, plumes of toxic, you know, of inorganic solvents and about this, that, and the other thing, but they never hear the stories of what it was like to watch, you know, your child die of leukemia. Because Fosher knew he was a dead duck if they ever got there. So, again, well, what to do about it? If indeed this, I mean, when you read a civil action or watch the movie, you kind of feel for the plaintiff, because it's definitely written, I would say, although the reporter does a marvelous job of just telling the story, you see the inside, you watch Schlickman, Jan Schlickman, the plaintiff's lawyer, sort of an interesting, you know, slick man, play on words almost, but he's a sympathetic character, although he certainly has his flaws, but he's sort of the protagonist in the story. You kind of identify with him. But whether you identify with him or not, this is kind of what modern day personal injury tort practice is about, and the question is, well, what should we do about it? Should we make it more difficult for plaintiffs to tell their story, in which case plaintiffs are less likely to recover? Should we leave it the way it is, figuring that big institutions will take care of themselves, and we have a plaintiff's bar that is ready, willing, and able to present the case of the victims in the most compelling light possible, and now we finally have a sort of evenly matched system? Or does the average person feel like they are watching this battle of the titans, and the average guy who's got a fender bender and just wants to get compensated has their life ruined because the tort system has been taken over by this huge battle of titans in which I no longer have a place. Anyway, that's what I want you to think about in the longer term. In the shorter term, an exam two weeks from tomorrow, the question is, recognizing the kinds of cases that are likely to be worrisome if you're a defendant, the kinds of cases which makes your mouth water if you're a plaintiff's lawyer, they are the cases in which there is a large pain and suffering injury, and in which the plaintiff has the opportunity to ask the jury to send a message. Corporate defendant or institutional defendant consciously chooses to do something or not do something, we now go back and revisit this and invite the jury to reaffirm their commitment to some important value, whatever that important value is, and award accordingly. Questions about that, Mr. Galler? Yes. Well, see, most of the time we try them together. In fact, most of the time a plaintiff's lawyer will present a case not in the sequence I have, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3. The plaintiff's lawyer will start with chapter 3. I want you to understand, ladies and gentlemen, what we're talking about here. You know, it's the broken arm or the lost child or the brain damage or whatever it is that is that this case is all about. Now, we go back, having done that, I now go back to chapter 1 and present the liability theory. Well, in the civil action case, the Woburn, Massachusetts cases, the defendant said, you know, this Jeremy Fosher, who happened to be buddies with the federal judge trying the case, it's just these strange ironies. As I said, Robert Duvall plays the Fosher character, and John Lithgow plays the federal judge and is this quirky kind of guy. In any event, Fosher says to the trial to the federal judge, look, we've got all this complicated scientific testimony. It's not even clear my client or this other client, who's represented by a much less skilled attorney. He says, it's not clear that our clients are responsible for any of this. Let's first figure out the scientific questions. If my client put this stuff in the water that got to the plaintiffs and caused their injury, well, then we'll go on to the other stuff. But if it didn't, I can go home. And the federal judge says, yeah, that's a good idea. And Schlickman says, no, you can't do it. Oh, yes, I can, says the federal judge. After all, I am a federal judge. And so they say, let's do this in stages. And Schlickman loses the first stage with respect to Fosher. He does win it with respect to the other defendant. They go on to settle it, but a huge amount of damage has been done in the process. And Schlickman's also just going broke. The question about bifurcation, about separating damages and liability, is a discretionary decision with the judge. It's rarely used. Most judges think, while we've got the jury here, let's hear the whole thing and get it done. In a very complex case, the judge may bifurcate, but it's pretty rare. The common way of bifurcating now is compensatory and punitive damages. So, for example, in the O.J. Simpson case, you first have the compensatory phase where you don't talk about punishment because it's too early to talk about that. If you decide there's liability, which they did, then you move to the punitive phase and you get the jury to come back. You present new evidence about the defendant's wealth and you know how big a baseball bat you should take to the defendant. So the punitive phase has a whole different cast to it than or feel to it than the compensatory phase. And those are bifurcated, but damages and liability are typically thought to be interconnected, and you can rarely persuade a judge. That's one of the things that was so Schlickman was totally unprepared for, because he never saw that coming, that a judge would ever do that. And he appealed it and lost because it's a discretionary decision. In any event, okay, anything else about Chapter 3? Let me do just a quick summary of Chapter 3 here at the risk of saying things you already know. But we had this play in three acts here. The first act was identifying the different types of damages, and you'll see the way in which having this inventory of different types of damages helps us see the way in which there's a use of these categories to mix and match in other aspects of Chapter 3. So, you know, property damage, economic damages, which include wage loss and medical expense. Except we've already done this, and I'm not going to test you on this. By the way, I'm not sure I've said this before, but the exam you just took was a cumulative exam. That is, everything that we had covered up to that point was fair game. Even stuff we covered on the mini-exam was fair game, as you saw. However, the next exam in 2 weeks from tomorrow will not be cumulative. I am going to do my best to avoid raising issues that require analysis you learned how to do before the first exam, before the most recent exam. So questions about, you know, market share liability or but-for causation or loss of a chance or abnormally dangerous activities. I'm going to try to stay away from that. I'm not suggesting you push the delete button just yet on everything you learn. Some will come back, sort of these intrusive memories, as in post-traumatic stress disorder. But to the extent I can, I will design a problem. I will not look for ways to give you interesting, causation theories or Paul's graph or what have you. It's all going to be the new material we've covered. So as I started to tell you about the categories of damages, I suddenly realized, oh, we've already covered that. Same with wrongful death. I won't put a wrongful death problem on the exam that's coming up because we've been there, done that. Okay, so after wrongful death, let's pick up at that point. Wrongful birth, wrongful life is, we talked, I hope helpfully yesterday in the Q&A session, that a so-called, what I call a garden variety medical malpractice case is one in which a child is injured through a doctor's negligence or somebody else's negligence, and the child recovers for the difference between how they would have been but for the malpractice or other fault as compared to the way they now are because of that. A wrongful birth or wrongful life claim, on the other hand, is a case in which a child is now in existence who would not have been but for the defendant's negligence. And when we have such a case, we have to confront the policy questions about how we want to handle those kinds of cases. With respect to a healthy child, many jurisdictions will say, in effect, no harm, no foul. You get the childbirth expenses, but that's it. Other jurisdictions, like Arizona, say, no, you get damages caused by the birth of an unwanted child minus the offsetting benefit that the child provides. Where, however, the child is born with disabilities, most jurisdictions will say, we use that approach taken in the Arizona case, measure the amount of damage that's been caused, and then deduct the offsetting benefit. Again, all kinds of policy questions about whether this is a good idea or a bad idea. Okay, then we looked at what I would call relationship injuries, bystander claims, loss of consortium claims, and there we saw this spectrum of approaches trying to balance the legitimate claims for compensation against the fear that the tort system is going to be way overextended and we're going to be doing sort of multiple recoveries for questionable victims and the problems associated with that. And most jurisdictions follow some kind of variant of the Dillon versus Legg rule, looking at was the plaintiff at the accident scene, did the plaintiff receive this kind of direct emotional shock, and how closely related are the parties? In a related way, consortium claims vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, whether it's almost universal that spouses get to recover for loss of consortium with their spouse, but the extension of that to parents, children, etc., varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Okay, then the material we started covering yesterday, the last part of the chapter, adjustments to the award. We first looked at the fact that an appellate court will sustain a verdict, however large, for the plaintiff, so long as the verdict is supported by substantial evidence. And as we've talked about, defendants may be in a tough position to argue against a large award, and the plaintiff may have a relatively open field in terms of simply adding up big numbers and asking the jury to award it. If there's substantial evidence to support it, the jury can award a very large amount. We then looked at tort reform and the way in which legislatures have responded to large jury verdicts by placing various kinds of limitations. And some courts have struck them down as being a violation of some constitutional provision, but many tort reform statutes have been approved, that's changed the landscape a little bit. The third thing was the collateral source rule we looked at, and the way in which the traditional rule was you don't even consider what else the plaintiff has gotten, although the reality is the plaintiff often has to pay it back. But the jury doesn't consider that in making the award. Some tort reform statutes have changed that, either by allowing the jury to consider it or, in some cases, actually reducing the award in light of it. And then finally, we looked at the idea of the scope of argument and the way in which you can use various rhetorical devices to get the jury to be generous. And you can place some limits on that, but a well-trained plaintiff's lawyer can work around those limitations and put the defendant in a tough position to respond to these appeals to the jury's kind of deepest values and attitudes and so forth. Questions about Chapter 3? I'll use 2 minutes here. Since I have 2 minutes, I'll use them. About Chapter 4. Actually, we've finished Part 1 now. Oh, no, I need to spend a few minutes on the tail end of the material here. Most of you have this section from the California statute about wrongful death. I already made reference to that back in the section on wrongful death, just so you now want to sort of remind you of that. I thought you didn't have it, now you do. California, by statute, decided they wanted to include people other than spouses or traditional family members. They wanted to include domestic partners as eligible plaintiffs in wrongful death cases. Obviously, this is a question of intense, public debate as to whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. One of the interesting things here is that it was done by the legislature, and at the same time, the question is whether courts can exercise, going back to Marine versus States Marine Lines, is this something that only a legislature can do? Or may a court take, an older precedent that excludes these things and add it? And again, raises all sorts of issues about the authority of judges and how they go about relating to previous legislative enactments, previous precedents. One of the other questions is the relationship between so-called domestic partner relationships, where the parties can't get legally married, as distinguished from domestic partnerships where they could get legally married, and do we treat them the same, or do we say, no, if you could get legally married, you have to get married in order to enjoy these benefits, an engaged couple is out of luck. But if you couldn't get legally married, then we use the domestic partner principles to essentially say, well, this is a way to handle that for people that can't. So again, all of these things hit lots of culture war issues about what's good or bad law, what's fair, what's unfair. again, my primary goal for you in reading these materials is to get a sense, here are the kinds of things that you would confront as a lawyer, here are the kinds of rights your client may enjoy, here are the kinds of limitations your client may encounter, and you may think it's good stuff or bad stuff, the law is sensible or the law is wrong, but at least you're aware of what issues are being raised. So we'll pick up with Chapter 4 tomorrow.